It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you've spent any amount of time on social media, you've probably run into conspiracy theories about the coronavirus. We'll find out how local leaders are trying to debunk them and to get accurate information out. First, for many people, finding a balance between parenting and working can be challenging in the best of times. And when the coronavirus pandemic arrived in the U.S., that combination became significantly more difficult for just about anyone as schools moved online and many jobs moved home as well. Fast forward to mid-July, and a lot of parents of school-aged kids are dealing with camps, summer school, and daycare, probably canceled, and even playdates or letting kids go to the park or pool, a thing of the past. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Does this describe what you've been going through the past few months? What's been the hardest to deal with? And have you found any approaches that have made it easier? What are your thoughts about sending kids back to school in the fall? What have you heard from your school district, if anything, and how will their plan match up with the demands of your job? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Deb Perlman created the Smitten Kitchen blog in 2006, and we've had her as a guest for Food Friday several times. Today, she's with us to talk about her recent piece for the New York Times titled, "In the COVID-19 Economy, You Can Have a Kid or a Job, You Can't Have Both." Deb, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Deb, can you give us a sense of what your work-parenting balance was pre-COVID?
It was not balanced. I don't actually think balance is something that exists. It's like a mythical concept. But I would say that things were closer to in balance. My kids went to school. I have a kid who is going into kindergarten and one that's going into sixth grade. I worked from home all day, and my husband had a job in office. And when the kids needed to go someplace after school, we had a babysitter that came. And I guess, you know, it worked. It wasn't ideal. Childcare is expensive. It was a significant part of our earnings even before, but we managed to make do.
And then fast forward to when COVID hit, and you are in New York, so you were in a very hot spot and one of the earlier places that was dealing with this. What happened when the pandemic changed everything?
What happened was, you know, schools were canceled and, you know, everybody kind of understood that it needed to happen. My husband was working from home instead of an office. I was already working from home, except for I wasn't working from home. I was homeschooling my kids. So my husband, who has a real boss, I'm self-employed. I am my own boss. I don't mean to disparage myself, but my husband had a real boss. And so he didn't miss a phone call or meeting. I mean, you know how it is. You can't be offline at any point when your boss is looking for you. So I handled most of the things during the day, and then I would end up working until about like 2 a.m. trying to get done everything that I didn't get done. And it was very, very stressful. But, you know, I understand that relative to the struggles that other working families have had, this is truly nothing. But I can tell you that it was stressful for us. And the whole time I just kept thinking, like, how is this going to work? Why is nobody talking about how impossible this is? Like, the fact is that if you both have to be at your jobs, and again, I have some flexibility, so I just flexed my way out of a job, basically, during the day. But if you both have to work, or even if you're a single parent, you have to work, and your kids are supposed to be homeschooled, how? Which job are you not supposed to do? Like, how is this tenable? Well, maybe it's just a couple months. And then what happened was, at the end of the school year, we started getting, you know, the emails from the school, like, we're not really sure we're doing this fall, but it looks like, you know, probably kids will be home 3 days and maybe they'll go to school 1 or 2 days a week. And I was like, oh, my God, this is never going to end. I mean, it's not never, but of course, we were so surprised and disappointed to learn that 4 months later, there was really no real plan of how we were going to make this work. And I that's where the op-ed came from, which was that, how are we supposed to do this? Are my kids supposed to skip kindergarten? Are they supposed to skip sixth grade? Or are we supposed to skip paying rent this year?
Hmm. Well, and you say that many parents that you have talked to or seen posting in different social media communities, things like that, this is a very common concern, frustration, source of exhaustion. And yet you say that not a lot of people are giving voice to that. Why do you think that is?
You know, I have read articles about parents struggling and the, you know, during COVID and kids struggling. I read a lot, but a lot of it was painting it as an emotional concern. It was that parents were burnt out. Parents are fried. Parents are at their wit's end. And I was like, we're not burnt out. We're not fried. This isn't emotional. This is an economic policy that's crushing us. It is telling us that businesses can be open, but schools can't. We're the ones being ground up in the gears. I'm not going to have emotional problems if we can solve this economic one. So I feel like when we pass things off as an emotional concern, we use it as an excuse to ignore it. This is the effect. It's not the cause. And that was the perspective that I wasn't hearing, which is why I, as somebody who usually writes about like cake and banana bread and spaghetti and meatballs, was like, I need to say something. Why? I kept waiting for somebody else to write the article and nobody did. And so I guess I just stepped into it.
Well, and I think also something that you actually did in the first 5 minutes of our conversation and something that I have found myself doing as well is saying, I'm struggling with this. This is a problem. I can't do X anymore. And then immediately following it up with, but I know for so many people, it's so much worse. And I wonder if that's part of it too, is that there's a little bit of self-consciousness or even guilt or shame in saying like, I can't make this work, because we know there are people who are struggling even more.
Absolutely. I mean, I talked about this in the article. I'm like, we are privileged. We have a significant amount of privilege. We had two incomes. We were able to afford childcare. We had savings. When my kids needed markers and books and whatever for, you know, homeschooling, we just grabbed it. We didn't think, oh my God, where is this money going to come from? I have a flexible job. And so therefore, I say it's flexible, but you know, I might just miss my book deadlines. God, I hope my editors aren't listening. So flexible isn't, you know, I may not get fired tomorrow. I think it's important to be aware of how many things we might still have going for us despite this, like, you know, how many things, you know, if you are two working class parents or one working class parent, or you have a job that's considered you essential, as in you actually have to physically be there, you're in so much worse of a jam. But I do feel like a lot of parents weren't speaking up for a couple reasons. And the first is that you can't go on social media and complain that you're having a hard time at work doing it. Mm-hmm. It's going to basically announce to any boss in a capitalist society that somebody else could do your job better. Nobody can risk not having a job right now. Unemployment is at a catastrophic high. So you can't go online and say you're having a hard time. You also don't want to sound like you're really volunteering your kids to go back to school when we know it might not be safe. We don't actually know that sending kids back is safe. It's not looking good. Nobody wants to be the parent who volunteered their kids for the salt mine only to find out that it was actually unsafe and a very bad idea. And I also just think the third part is that if you're homeschooling all day and you're working, doing your job until 2 a.m, who's got energy left to write an op-ed? I mean, I would talk to my friends about this. I would talk to mom friends. We were all talking about it, but nobody has time to yell about it. So I don't know. I guess I did.
We're talking right now with Deb Pearlman. You can get back to that eventually. We're talking with Deb Pearlman right now. She created the Smitten Kitchen blog in 2006. And we are talking with her today about a recent opinion piece she wrote for the New York Times titled, In the COVID-19 Economy, You Can Have a Kid or a Job, You Can't Have Both. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. And Deb, you say in your article that when people do talk about it, the conversation often focuses on the wrong things, and that serves to deflect attention from what the real core issues are. And one of those is, you just kind of touched on, is whether schools are safe, teachers could get sick. It's almost pitting parents and teachers against each other when really they should be on the same team.
It is the last thing I want to do. I absolutely understand why teachers are saying, I can't even get enough paper towels for my classroom. We keep running out of chalk, and you're going to tell me that you can protect us against COVID? I totally understand. And in New York, I mean, again, you know, in New York especially, we have underfunded, overcrowded, understaffed public schools. They're not, you know, there are some wonderful schools, and it doesn't mean that they're not doing an amazing job with what they have, but this is not a place that can just pivot. We can't just magically invent 8 square foot per kid. It's not, they can't invent, you know, they don't even have a budget for a lot of their school supplies, nonetheless plexiglass dividers and PPEs. And there's a lot of logistical questions that aren't being answered. And I think the problem is that it's coming off as parents versus teachers. And I think that we should be moving our concerns further up the chain. Schools need money. They need funding. And they need the ability to think outside the box. This is not something that schools can do. State governments can. The federal government could open its wallet. There are creative solutions, but they're not going to come from your local school district, and it's unfair to expect them to.
Well, and one of the interesting aspects of that is just kind of asking that question assumes that teachers, that there's no overlap between the group of people who are teachers and the group of people who are parents. And there's a lot of overlap there. And so if you have teachers who are going back into what's potentially an unsafe environment, they also have to figure out what to do with their kids.
It's absolutely impossible. In fact, early on, one of the most heartbreaking things I was hearing from was actually one of my son's former teachers, and she was home with her two kids, and her husband had a job that he cannot miss a minute of. So she was supposed to be homeschooling her two kids while fully teaching a kindergarten class, not like kids that you can send off to do work on their own, fully teaching a kindergarten class remotely. And her story to me was so heartbreaking because, I mean, we talk about it being hard. It's impossible for a teacher with kids. And then I also heard from a lot of teachers who have elderly parents at home, or they have their own 7-year-old who's immunocompromised. They can't walk in, their trust in the schools to keep them safe is limited, and they're correct too. But I think the problem is that it's not us versus schools. It's, can we think more creatively about schools? Can the schools get the funding they may need to open? And if they can't, and I'm not just looking at schools to fix this, can we protect parents' jobs? Can workplace protections be put in? Can you have paid leave if you need to teach your kids all day? Can you not be professionally penalized if you can't make a meeting because or is the official government policy that we're just, it's okay if my kid misses kindergarten in sixth grade as long as I can pay my rent on time? I mean, one of these things is going to have to give. And most people can't afford to live without money. Most people can't afford to live without a roof over their head or food on their plate.
We're talking right now with food blogger Deb Perlman about her recent piece for the New York Times titled, "In the COVID-19 Economy, You Can Have a Kid or a Job, You Can't Have Both." And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you trying to balance taking care of your children and working from home or maybe having to go to work? What's been the hardest part? Do you feel like you're doing either one of those things very well? And what would you need to make this new way of life sustainable? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Deb Perlman, the food blogger behind the Smitten Kitchen website. While we usually talk with her about food, today she's with us to discuss her recent piece for the New York Times titled, "In the COVID-19 Economy, You Can Have a Kid or a Job, You Can't Have Both." And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you currently working from home while also taking care of children who might usually be in school, childcare, or at camp? Is it sustainable? If not, what would you need to make it work? And if it is working for you, what has made that possible? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Deb, one of the things that you point to that is not necessarily a helpful aspect of the discussion when it does happen about this crisis is that you should be enjoying the extra, quote unquote, quality time with your kids. How would you respond to that?
I am. It's got nothing to do with the economy, though. I love it. I love not having to miss these months with them. It's always a little struggle. But that does not mean that I should have my economic prospects removed or that I shouldn't work. I might enjoy having them doodle and seeing extra things that they're doing, but that's got nothing to do with it. I feel like what the person is arguing when they say that is they're arguing is, shouldn't you be home all the time? I feel like there is this low murmuring, barely low, below the surface, that actually moms shouldn't be working. And so when we in the early months saw a lot of these, you know, people making banana bread with their kids, which, of course, as a food blogger, I am all for, and the crafts and everything else. It's a lovely, it seems like a return to classic values, blah, blah, blah. But it feels like, it felt like it was just people were using it to validate this idea of, you know, of backwards progress.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Thomas in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Thomas.
Hey, what's going on?
Not much, but what do you have to say?
So I was just going to share my story. All right. So I am an iron worker. So I build buildings, steel, you know, big steel buildings and all that. So we never stopped working. None of us. We're all working every day. And I got the virus. Got sick. I was on my back for like a month and a week, and then went right back to work, and then had to get back in shape, get my lungs back in shape and all that stuff. And at this point, everything's cool, you know, but it took, the main issue I had was it took the state so much time to back pay me for the unemployment. That's the only issue I had, you know.
And Thomas, what's it going to be like if the kids don't go back to school in the fall, or if they're only in school a few days a week and you need to go back to work? What would happen for you and your family then?
Oh, their mom does all that. I just pay the child support. I just send the check.
And is she working as well?
Yeah, she's doing some type of thing from home on a computer or something. I don't know what it is.
All right. Well, thanks so much for sharing that story, Thomas. And Deb, you know, it's every family situation is a little different, but a lot of the elements are the same of, you know, that balance of I need to pay the rent, I need to pay the bills, and my kids need to be taken care of. And then if you get sick, that's a whole other element.
It's terrifying. And I, since the article was published, I've gotten an avalanche of emails from parents, and I have called my inbox one of the most heartbreaking places on the internet, because the stories that people are telling me about the struggles they've had since March are just devastating. And, you know, maybe each alone doesn't seem worth, like, you know, changing the course of everything that's happened, but these stories really add up. And you hear about people whose kids have really backslid with a lot, that not getting the services they needed from school. And I've heard from many people who have been laid off, and, you know, they say it was a staff reduction, but it sure seemed to focus on the people who are having the hardest time juggling. And I've heard from people who say, I accepted a job and that I've been hoping to get for 10 years, and I'm going to have to, you know, not take this job in the end because I can't do it this fall if my kids aren't in school. And I've also heard from people who, you know, they sort of pause their careers thinking it might just be a couple months and they're never going to get back to work. And I think one of the saddest things, we know this disproportionately affects moms. And we also know, because studies after studies have shown, that people who leave the workforce have a really hard time getting back in. I mean, I want to make this clear that, like, I don't think it's on schools to open to, like, save parents' jobs. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, there's a larger conversation that has existed before COVID about why we need universal child care. And, you know, if you want to look at the, you know, the short-term picture is, I think that we need the kind of bailouts for working parents who are trying to school at home that we would have for airlines or banks. We have bailouts for other groups that need it. But in the longer term, you know, I think what this is really laying bare is the idea is that we just don't have good early childhood child care in this country. We don't look at it as essential because we don't really love the idea of both parents working, and it's held us back. And it's really come to a head since March when any available system of child care fell apart for basically everyone except for people who had such deep pockets that they could buy their way out of it somehow.
We're talking with Deb Pearlman right now about her recent article about trying to work and take care of your kids during the COVID-19 crisis. And Deb, you make a lot of pretty strong statements in your article, including this one. We are not burned out because life is hard this year. We are burned out because we are being rolled over by the wheels of an economy that has bafflingly declared working parents inessential. And, you know, it is very interesting because people who never would have been called essential workers before are now being called essential. What would it look like if all working parents were treated in that way right now?
I think we would have creative solutions. I think there would have been the I think that we would have had to fund schools differently so they could make the changes that needed to be made, because the kids would have to be educated. I think right now, if you have some sort of white-collar job or that's allowing you any kind of flexibility to work from home, it kind of looks like things are going okay. You know, we're not really sure if the kids are getting educated, but it seems like they might be. But that's just, it just seems like a really, it's a terrible way to talk about kids' education. Like, they might have sixth grade, they may not have it. Like, it's whatever, we'll find out. Like, that's how we treat, like, our next generation of Americans. It seems really upsetting. So I think that if we considered all parents' jobs essential, because if you have to do it and your kid also has to be schooled, it is essential. It's not as essential as going to work on a construction site or something like that, but it's the same thing where you're expected to do two things. I think we would be taking more seriously the school part, because right now I think it's the kids who are being really getting the worst end of this.
And Deb, briefly, as we start to wrap up, have there been any bright spots during all of this that have helped to keep you going?
Have there been any
bright spots during all of this that have helped keep you going?
There have been many bright spots. I mean, I do enjoy seeing my kids more, although I think that they would be far happier if they were in school and fully thriving. I think it's a challenging time, and I think that if you can survive it, you feel very triumphant. But I've been impressed, you know, by what people are able to pull off and what they're able to do with homeschooling. But I also think, if nothing else comes out of this, and hopefully a lot more will, I think that we can all see the invaluable job the teachers are doing, and that they should be paid better for what they do, because try to do it for even a week with a 4 or 5 year old. No matter how smart you think you are, you realize that you're wildly under-equipped. And I'm hoping that we'll see a different kind of conversation around childcare after this, because it's always been a struggle. If you had two kids,
and we're going to have to leave it there, Deb. Sorry, we are out of time. Deb Perlman created the Smitten Kitchen blog. She recently wrote a piece for the New York Times titled, "In the COVID-19 Economy, You Can Have a Kid or a Job. You Can't Have Both." I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Construction of Wisconsin's largest solar farm was delayed due to the coronavirus pandemic. Now it may be pushed back again. Coming up, we'll look at the scope of the Iowa County project and how and why the timeline is changing. Now, you may have seen a news item this weekend about a 30-year-old man in Texas who died from COVID-19. He had attended a party that was meant to test whether COVID-19 was real or not by being intentionally exposed to someone who had tested positive. Just before he died, the man said to a nurse tending to him, "I think I made a mistake. I thought this was a hoax, but it's not." Local officials in Wisconsin are on the front lines of debunking conspiracy theories related to COVID-19. False information gains traction on social media, then city council members and health department leaders have the burden of convincing people the rumors aren't true. Howard Hardy is a journalist based in Madison. He's a fellow at First Draft, which trains journalists to detect and report on disinformation. He reported this story for Wisconsin Watch. Howard talked about his findings with WPR host Keely Boltina.
The false conspiracies you're writing about are rooted in contact tracing. Remind us what that is.
Yeah, contact tracing identifies and informs people who have been in contact with someone who has tested positive for COVID-19.
Yeah, people just don't seem to trust contact tracing. Where's the concern coming from?
Suspicion and mistrust of contact tracers kind of gained traction early on in the pandemic. You know, in the middle of March, you could see some kind of goofy ideas surrounding contact tracing kind of germinate and gain traction, where a lot of people were associating it with some sort of like Big Brother style surveillance state.
And that brings us to an Appleton City Council meeting. Local leaders there, they took wrong or unsubstantiated concerns that were swirling, especially on social media, and they started talking about them. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they got in this position where they felt like they had to address these rumors on social media head on. A big post that seemed to be really influential and directed a lot of residents toward the Appleton City Council appeared on the Facebook page Wisconsinites Against Excessive Quarantine. It was calling on people to oppose this funding that was being considered by the Appleton City Council. They were considering accepting up to $1.2 million in state reimbursement for contact tracing efforts. And this post warned that some really bad stuff was going to happen at the city council meeting, and that surveillance cameras had, in fact, already been set up all around the city. So it really seemed like it was stirring up a lot of fear and mistrust of contact tracers in general. And so the council felt like they had to address those rumors directly, which they did during their June 17th meeting.
How did they do that?
They prompted city staff members to address some of the specific rumors that they had been hearing from residents. They kind of got bombarded with emails and messages from people who lived in Appleton and people who weren't from there as well. And so they asked city staffers whether the city had any plans to forcibly remove anyone from their homes, or if they had plans to build an isolation center in the city of Appleton. And they also posed this question of whether or not cameras were being installed for monitoring people as they self-isolated or quarantined in their homes. And the intent there was just to provide a forum for the city staffers to kind of shoot these rumors down and address them directly.
What do you hear from local leaders about this, about them being questioned about things like putting up cameras everywhere?
Well, one of the main interviews in my story was with Katie Van Zeeland, who is an older person on the city council. And she was really pretty frustrated with the situation because she felt like she was being put in this position where she had to address these rumors that were kind of impossible to disprove. She felt like the burden of proof was being placed on the city council, and she just recounted this really frustrating experience of like not knowing how to prove something isn't true.
Howard Hardy is a journalist who's written an investigative piece for Wisconsin Watch. We're talking about local officials needing to debunk conspiracy theories amid COVID-19 as leaders try to get their arms around this in the pandemic and protect communities. This is the Ideas Network. How much does this distrust when it comes to contact tracing lay into, or is just kind of one piece of a greater challenge that communities are seeming to distrust government?
I would say that it's part and parcel of that greater trend of just questioning science and being skeptical of government officials, including local officials. We've seen a lot of mistrust directed at public health departments since the COVID-19 pandemic began. So I see this issue of the contact tracers fitting into that broader pattern of being skeptical of our local leaders and science-backed protocols.
What are you finding about people who hesitate to give these contact tracers names of friends or family they've been in contact with?
Well, I've heard from our local health department here, Department of Public Health, Madison, Dane County, that they're encountering a lot of skepticism from young people who feel like they've gotten in trouble when they are contacted by a contact tracer. They feel like if they reveal who they've been near recently, that they're going to get their friends in trouble, or there'll be some consequences for participating in gatherings. When really the contact tracers are trying to keep take their own personal judgments entirely out of it, and they just really want to track the spread of COVID-19 in our community.
And yet you also heard that some contact tracers are not having problems, that people are really cooperating with them.
Yeah, I did also hear from a contact tracer who said everybody has been really cooperative and understanding of the protocol and haven't really questioned the purpose of it, because at this point, I think a lot of people are familiar with the term and what contact tracers are all about, whereas a few months ago, I don't think hardly anybody knew what a contact tracer was, even though they do this for other communicable diseases as well. So in some cases, I think residents have been really understanding and cooperative.
Wisconsin's attorney general has warned that scammers could try to take advantage of people. I mean, that's a real issue. What won't legitimate contact tracers do? What won't they ask us?
Yeah, they won't ask for your money. They won't ask for your social security number or bank or credit card information. And they won't identify the person who contracted COVID-19 by name. They'll always call by phone. You're not going to hear from them via text message or email. And they're going to identify themselves by their first and last name and the health department that they work for.
This issue is bigger than Wisconsin, and yet we're really putting this on local officials, and they're trying to balance dispelling things that are untrue that worry community members with also not wanting to promote those rumors. How are they trying to figure that out?
Yeah, it really seems like they're between a rock and a hard place, because I feel like a lot of our local officials are having to answer for decisions that are being made on the federal and state levels. This funding that became so controversial in Appleton is actually CARES Act funding. So we see state and federal level funding trickling down to local communities. And then the local officials are really bearing the brunt of the misinformation. They're the ones that have to answer to their citizens directly. And in many cases, especially in a small community like Appleton, community members probably see their council members on the street or may even know where they live. So there's really no like hiding from residents. So I really feel like they're kind of in this pressure zone.
Part of your work is to figure out misinformation and correct it. And I just have to wonder, I mean, is there anything that regular people can do to help stop the rumors and the conspiracy theories that harm our work to slow the spread of this new coronavirus? What do we do?
Since I started doing this social media monitoring work, I've heard from a lot of members of the public who are just like, hey, how do we recognize this stuff online? How do we avoid spreading misinformation ourselves? And there are a couple of handy little tricks that you can employ. Just avoid sharing something that comes from a source that you're not familiar with. Say you see a post on social media that has some sensational headline that evokes a really strong emotional response in you. Before sharing that information, take a moment to assess the source. It's always really helpful to just do a little research. It can be as simple as copy-pasting the name of the publication into Google and seeing what it says. There are a number of fact-check and debunk-style websites that are helpful resources as well. And the most important thing is just to kind of check your emotions and take a moment to assess where the information is coming from before you share it.
Howard, thank you for helping us understand your reporting more.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Howard Hardy talking with WPR host Keely Boltina. They discussed how local officials are trying to debunk false claims related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Howard is a fellow at First Draft, which has a partnership with Wisconsin Watch. You can read the full story online. Just visit WPR.org/centraltime for a link. Coming up, we'll get an update on the construction of Wisconsin's biggest solar farm and why it could be delayed again. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, less than 4 months out from the November election day, the Federal Elections Commission lacks a quorum again. We'll find out why and what it means for the integrity of our vote. First, construction of Wisconsin's largest solar farm is at risk of being delayed for a second time. The Badger Hollow Solar Farm in Iowa County in southwestern Wisconsin is being built in two phases. The first phase was put on hold for about 4 months due to the coronavirus. Now, phase two could be pushed back because of trade tariffs. When both portions are finally complete, Badger Hollow is expected to generate 300 megawatts of electricity. That's enough to power 77,000 homes annually. Meanwhile, plans are moving forward for other large solar farms across the state, but the economic downturn that began earlier this year may present a problem for future solar projects as well. Danielle Kading is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter based in Superior. Danny, good to have you back on the show.
Hi, Judah. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Well, can you give us the backstory on the Badger Hollow Solar Farm? How did the project first come about?
Yeah, well, you pretty much covered it, so I don't know what more I have to say about it. But yeah, you know, the Wisconsin Public Service Commission approved the 300-megawatt Badger Hollow Solar Farm last year. And as you said, it could generate enough electricity to power around 77,000 homes. And so utility providers Wisconsin Public Service and Madison Gas and Electric partnered to acquire the first 150 megawatts of that project, known as Badger Hollow 1. And they, and then later on in August of last year, Madison Gas and Electric and We Energies partnered to purchase the remaining portion of that farm. And as you've said, it's encountered some delays related to the coronavirus pandemic and also could be delayed due to the tariff situation that we're seeing right now.
So as we said, this would be Wisconsin's largest solar farm if it's completed and completed at the scale that has been planned. What is it about this site in Iowa County that makes it a good place to put something of that scale?
You know, that's a good question. I think it's just the location of, you know, there's a lot of farmland there that is suitable for this type of project. But that also has raised the ire of people who live in the area and farmers who have been concerned about maintaining the rural character of the region. So while it's being embraced by those who are pushing for renewable energy and that transition, it's not without conflict or controversy.
I want to get into some of the specifics of this project, but I'm having a hard time picturing what a solar farm looks like. I mean, I think we know what those wind turbines look like on a landscape, but what does a solar farm look like?
Yeah, well, it's basically just tons of solar arrays or solar panels. And this project would cover 3,500 acres of cropland or flat farmland in Iowa County. So it's pretty massive when you think about the scale of these types of projects.
So how did COVID-19 delay construction of phase one of the Badger Hollow Solar Farm?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, with the state's safer at home order that was put in place by Governor Tony Evers, you know, there were some difficulties with getting workers to the site. Or for the developer Invenergy to get workers to the site because, you know, there's been concerns about social distancing and maintaining safety during the pandemic. And so that delayed the portion of the project for about 4 months, pushing back the time that the first phase would come online to April of next year. And now it looks like, you know, it's possible that the construction on the second phase could be delayed as well because of changes in the trade atmosphere right now related to solar panels.
So how far along is the project right now? Are they done with phase one? Are they still trying to finish that? Where are we at?
Yeah, they have started construction. You know, they've been doing some site preparation and clearing roads and things like that. And they have solar panels on site that are ready to be installed. And then they're going to be moving forward on that throughout this summer. So there's work that's going on out there. It's just that there's been a little bit of uncertainty and delays that the project has encountered. And I can go into more of the tariff situation if you'd like.
Absolutely. But let me let people know that they are listening to Danielle Kading, who is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter based in Superior. We're talking about what would be the largest solar farm in Wisconsin, in southwestern Wisconsin, the Badger Hollow Solar Farm. And so, Danny, COVID-19 delayed phase one, tariffs are seen as a threat to the start of phase two. Why do tariffs come in at that point?
Yeah, so, well, it has to do with the developer and Invenergy. They want to use these special type of panels called bifacial panels. And basically, these types of solar panels are special because they can pick up light from both sides of the panel. And so utilities and developers really want to use it because it increases productivity. So with the possibility of tariffs being placed on these panels, it had the potential to significantly increase costs for the utilities that are involved, and that would mean also for their ratepayers. So the decision was made to extend the construction timeline to give the developer more time to acquire these panels and stay within the project's costs.
So where would these panels be coming from that they're getting caught up in these trade tariffs?
Well, they would be coming from overseas because they're really not domestically manufactured at a high rate, or at least not enough to meet the demand that we're seeing right now with the growth in the solar industry. And so recently, the Trump administration withdrew an exemption for these panels from tariffs, but a U.S. court, the U.S. Court of International Trade, blocked that move. And so right now it's kind of in limbo as to whether or not these panels will encounter tariffs or not.
So it sounds like it's not necessarily an issue of whether they would be available. It's whether they would be affordable.
Right, exactly.
Have the coronavirus and tariffs delayed other solar projects in Wisconsin, or is the Badger Hollow solar farm at a particular stage of development that it's getting hit harder?
You know, there have been minor delays related to the coronavirus pandemic. If you look at Invenergy, they're also proposing to develop the Paris solar farm in Kenosha County. And if that were built, it would produce 200 megawatts of power. But that's still in the process of being evaluated by regulators. And commission staff or staff at the Public Service Commission requested and received an extension to review that project because they said that they were encountering some delays or challenges due to the pandemic and the number of solar generating facilities that they're currently reviewing.
There must be at least a fair amount of demand for solar energy if there are all of these big projects that are going forward.
Yes. Yeah. We're seeing a lot of growth in solar right now across the country. And we're also expected to see that here in Wisconsin as well. You know, solar is expected to generate a little more than 4% of the state's electricity by 2026. And, you know, if you look at 2 years ago, it really was only like a tenth of a percent of all the electricity generated in Wisconsin was produced by utility scale solar projects. So we're starting to see utilities move in that direction because in part the costs to implement these projects are coming down, and also because they're being driven by their customers and investors who want to see more investment in renewable energy.
So, Danny, what are you going to be watching for next to gauge whether this project is going to be able to catch up on their timeline or if it might be delayed indefinitely?
Well, I guess we're just going to have to wait and see. I mean, right now they're on track to have the first phase of the project come online next April. And then I think the second phase, if I'm not mistaken, would come online sometime in 2022. So I guess it'll depend on what we see with the appetite for investment right now too on other projects. So we're just going to kind of pay attention to it and see what happens.
Well, Danny, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Judith.
Danielle Kading is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter based in Superior. We talked with her about the construction delays for the Badger Hollow Solar Farm in Iowa County. That's in the southwestern portion of Wisconsin. The setbacks are the result of the coronavirus and trade tariffs. Badger Hollow would be the largest solar farm in the state when it is completed. You can read Danny's whole article by going over to WPR.org and clicking on the news tab. And if you live near a solar farm, we'd love to hear about it. Email us at centraltime at centraltime@wpr.org. The coronavirus pandemic has led to shortages of some interesting and unexpected items. Toilet paper comes to mind, but also chicken, hand sanitizer, gardening supplies, flour, yeast, and coins. It turns out that for several reasons, change has become hard to come by for banks, which means it's not available for them to distribute to businesses or individuals who might need some. Businesses that were closed, and maybe still are, had a bunch sitting in cash drawers and safes. Also, many purchases have gone online, and more in-person purchases are by credit card or debit card now. That's to avoid close interactions between customers and employees. One impact of this coin shortage is that here in Wisconsin, pick and save stores are not going to be giving change back in coins. Instead, they'll put the amount on the customer's loyalty card, or they'll encourage the balance to be donated to their parent company's Zero Hunger, Zero Waste Foundation. I could not find any update on how the change shortage is affecting coin laundry usage. So if you've got a change jar that you haven't emptied recently, and if your bank is accepting it, maybe think about cashing it in. You'll help out the Federal Reserve and get a little spending money out of it, too. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.